Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois, now playing at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
All right, welcome to the State of Sound podcast. I am Lance Tauzer, the Director of Exhibits here at the ALPLM, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Jeff Tweedy from Wilco. Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, great. So, the purpose of this exhibit, the State of Sound, I was trying to make a case that Illinois has really offered the world some amazing music and musicians. And, you know, we reached out to you and a lot of other artists during the pandemic to borrow some artifacts to help tell that story. And again, we appreciate you being involved in the exhibit. But I really wanted to ask you a little bit about your upbringing in Illinois and essentially the culture in which you found yourself and how that sort of played into your musical development.
I grew up in southern Illinois, across the river from St. Louis. I guess a lot of people would say that that's not all the way south in southern Illinois, but southern Illinois in terms of where most people in Illinois live.
Right.
It was a little bit isolated. I have to, even though we weren't that far from a pretty big city, we didn't tend to go there a whole lot. So, I'm not sure, what cultural references I would have other than the radio. And maybe just some sort of oral tradition that seemed to be around when I was growing up with my uncles and my cousins playing guitars and stuff like that at family gatherings.
And was it essentially that's how you got your interest in music is from your family?
I think from my family's records.
Right.
I was the youngest by 10 years in my family. So everybody was pretty much gone by the time I came around. I was kind of like the youngest and only child. And so I had a lot of loneliness or solitude, I guess, growing up, and records became my friends pretty quickly. And luckily they had left a lot of really cool records around. My aunt and my sister both bought a lot of really great Beatles, Motown singles and things like that, and Bob Dylan. And so I lucked out with a treasure trove of pretty cool records to get me, keep me company and for the most part, but also kind of really inspire me. And then not that long after that, my brother came back from college, I guess when I was in my probably before I was a teenager even, and gave me a big crate of records that he had accumulated at college that was bizarre, just like for the time.
Anything to this, Midwest sensibilities or work ethic that played a part in sort of your musical career? We kind of pride ourselves on this, sort of straightforwardness and this sense that, that the Midwest has, something very authentic.
I think that my experience has been that those things, common traits that you find in Midwesterners really lend themselves well to being in a band. I guess the only thing that would be detrimental is our habit of sometimes being a little bit too agreeable. And I think that sometimes in a band, or at least in a music making environment, you benefit from pushing back a little bit here and there. But yeah, my dad worked hard. My mom worked hard. Everybody that I saw growing up that was doing well in their life was, seemed to have endless energy. My aunt Gail, was, I don't know if I've ever seen her tired, you know, it's just a weird thing. So, but I like working. So I don't know if that's a Midwestern thing or if it's just the luck of the draw, but I enjoy work. I find it very enjoyable to feel like I'm working.
Your dad worked on the railroads, isn't that correct? Yeah. You can't get much more Midwest than that.
Yeah, for 46 years. Yeah. He dropped out of high school when my mom got pregnant and got a job at the Altman Southern Railways, helping, I guess, kind of the transition between diesel and old locomotives at the time, I guess. He worked in the pits underneath the trains, and eventually somebody decided that he was pretty smart, or recognized that he was pretty smart, and sent him to do a summer program in Arizona, where he learned how to program computers with punch cards. So he got a promotion up into the control tower of switching.
Wow. Okay. So skipping ahead sort of to your career, many in the media have described your first big band, Uncle Tupelo, as sort of the first alternative country artist, specifically the No Depression album in 1990. Is this recognition that you sort of realized as a genre developing sort of in real time, or is it something that it needed to sort of happen and you could look back and say, oh, I was a part of that? I mean, how did that all happen to get, to come together, at least from your perspective?
Well, I mean, at the time and for a long time after, I've always, felt like we felt compelled to push back a little bit and argue the case that country music has always been a part of rock and roll. That we weren't, really doing anything that different, but the genres were getting more specified at that time. It seemed like Rolling Stones had lots of country sounding songs, and they would never be called anything other than a rock and roll band. Bands later than that, we liked bands like X that had they had songs that had a country element, so we always pushed back. But having said all of that, as I get older, I do see that every generation kind of needs its band or a little bit of some messenger for some of those same ideas. And I do see that at that particular time, we facilitated that. And it makes me happy, but I don't take a great deal of, pride in myself as an innovator or anything.
Yeah, I don't know how often you would sort of refer to yourself in a pioneering state. I get that, but that's interesting that it's changed a little over time. With your experience with Uncle Tupelo, what sort of lessons did you learn, in the next phase of your career, in the next band? What were your takeaways from your experience in Tupelo that sort of helped you evolve and that you have benefited from as far as the Wilco band?
I don't know. By the time Uncle Tupelo ended, I mean, Uncle Tupelo only made 4 records, but I've been playing in a band since, early in high school. So, I felt seasoned by the time I started Wilco. I kind of felt like I knew how to. It's weird. You take for granted all the little things that people do to make a band go. but even setting up your gear in the right configuration on stage and putting your pedals in the right order and guitar pedals and taping things down. And you learn just the, a lot of the tricks of the trade. So by the time Wilco came around, I felt like I was pretty adept at that part of it. The creative side of it, I think I was still learning how to write songs for myself. I think in Uncle Tupelo, this is a pretty Midwestern trait, I guess. I felt like a people pleaser to some degree. I really kind of wanted my songs to fit next to Jay Farrar's songs. And I think I tried to absorb that atmosphere, you know, and fit in with the overall aesthetic of what we were trying to do together.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And with regards to the sort of formation of Wilco and the career arc, which, you know, has really spanned quite a significant amount of time now. You've had lots and lots of critical acclaim. I just recently watched your documentary, How to Broken Heart, and you got a Grammy in 2005. You know, it's kind of interesting about how regarded the band is. How is the critical acclaim and the peer, I mean, the amount of collaborations you've done, it's obvious that people look to you and your band as someone to be regarded musically. That must, you must garner some real appreciation for adoration from your peers. How does that really impact you and affect you?
You know, it's really nice to be acknowledged. Everybody, I don't think anybody really has a problem with being regarded well. but I don't know how much. There's putting yourself out into the world also draws a lot of scrutiny, and in this day and age, there's a fair amount of trolling that would go on, like in something as innocuous as a picture of a fluffy kitten. People can find almost anything to complain about, almost anything, and so you see both things, and I try not to let either one of them be that weigh that heavily on what I do from day to day. The sustaining part of it for me has always been being able to work at writing songs and feel like I'm getting better at playing the guitar and singing, and all that other stuff. I guess it would be worse if it was, I can imagine I would have less energy for it if it was being met with like complete indifference. I have a tough time over emphasizing that side of it for myself, because I kind of don't want to get addicted to needing that, because the parts of it that I love to do are so sustaining in and of themselves.
Oh, good. Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose if you don't focus too much on the positive or the negatives, you can, or the over, and you know, on either side, the extremes, if you will, it allows you to kind of clear your pathway forward. Mm-hmm. I wanted to mention that the guitar that you loaned us is on display in a rather large case that also includes some materials from the very first Farm Aid here in Illinois, in Champaign. And I know that Wilco has had a number of Farm Aid affiliations. Uh-huh. Can you talk a little bit about the guitar you loaned us, its sort of story, and specifically your recollections or understanding or the importance of Farm Aid?
You're going to have to refresh my memory. Which guitar did we end up sending? That was a while ago.
Yeah, it was almost a year ago. It's a green Tele. And it's one that you sort of Frankenstein together, the way your manager described it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I used to play that guitar a lot on stage. Yeah, I remember. I know which one it is now. Farm Aid. I mean, I think the first Farm Aid was in, was it in Champaign or Bloomington Normal?
Champaign. Yep.
Yeah, Champaign. That happened when I was in high school. Do you know what the year was? Is it 84? 85.
85, I think it is, yeah.
Yeah. So my senior year in high school. So I just remember everybody coming, like some, I didn't get to go, but I had a lot of friends that drove up for it. And it was a big deal. And
oh, so, it's huge.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. So many, many years later being asked to do it, and we've done it three or four times, maybe. It's great to be a part of it. And, I'm always kind of proud that the first one was in Illinois.
It's interesting. I think I read that you were at least 98, 2005 and 2008, as I recall, but I couldn't track down all the times you've been a part of it, you know, and they haven't, obviously most of those concerts haven't been in Illinois, but the first one was humongous. It was at the campus of University of Illinois, and it had a crazy variety of artists. It was really focused. I mean, actually it didn't focus on any particular genre there. I think Bon Jovi played or something like that. So it was a crazy conglomeration of artists.
Wasn't Dylan there or something? Was Dylan there?
I believe Dylan was the first one. And only up until recently, I think Neil Young has been at all of them. I think this last one during the pandemic, I think he decided that he shouldn't do it during the pandemic. But there's been some that have been at all of them. But it's always been one of those ones, you know, it's an easy one to support. You know, we're supporting small, you know, family farms. You would think that there isn't anything, you know, there is no downside to supporting, you know, agriculture, especially small agriculture, right. Especially in our state.
Right.
You talked a little bit about being from the Midwest and having sort of that agreeable, you know, aspect to your personality. And you have had some amazing collaborations in your career. One of them I just wanted to ask about how it came together and what your takeaways were with Mavis Staples, because she's featured in our exhibit as well.
Oh, man. Yeah, Mavis and I always have slightly different takes on how we got together. And I think it's because it was kind of like an arranged marriage or something, you know. I think her people told her that I wanted to meet with her about her help, you know, maybe seeing if I could produce one of her records. And the way it was presented to me was, Mavis wants to meet you to see if you want to, you know, if you'd be interested in producing one of her records. I think we were both kind of, you know, set up to get together by our respective people.
An arranged marriage. We met
in arranged marriage. Yeah. like a blind date. I met with her and Yvonne, her sister, who passed away recently. Rest in peace. I drove down to the South Side, and we sat in one of the diners down there, and I just drank a couple gallons of iced tea, and we talked, and it was easy. We just have a chemistry or, you know, some connection. I'm not a super metaphysical new agey guy, but I do think that there are, you know, times where you can't really explain how you feel so familiar with somebody. And, I think that was the case for myself. And since then it's just been, you know, I feel like we've just been part of the same family. She's adopted my kids because neither of their grandmothers are alive.
Oh.
And so she lets them call her Grandma Mavis.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, yeah. So about the coolest thing ever.
That's pretty pretty damn cool. All right. Well, and it's funny because you mentioned your kids. The first time I ever saw your sort of family unit was a part of this relatively obscure documentary when you guys all went to New Zealand for the Oxfam project with Neil Finn from Crowded House.
Right.
And you and your family are in the, and this is like turned sort of right around 2000, 2001. I can't even remember when it was, but you know, your kids were really little and, and it's such a lovely project that they were doing down there. And the other artist that joined you in New Zealand, that was kind of the first time, you know, we got a glimpse of your family. And then, your pandemic experience, I really wanted to touch on because the Tweety show and your kids and Spencer and everybody being involved. Just give me just a little taste of how that all came together and what your takeaways on that is.
Well, my wife is like, she has the entertainment or media tastes of a teenage girl. And so she spends a lot of time on social media and TikTok and things like that. And she, you know, she really enjoys it. And so she, for a while, had been talking about, you know, streaming something live on Instagram just to see if it was fun, a fun thing to do. And then, you know, Wilco was out on the road and the tour got canceled right at the beginning of the pandemic. And we came home and Susie was, you know, we were just talking about how a lot of people that Susie was seeing online and on the different chat groups that follow Wilco, how disappointed everybody was and how miserable the idea of not being able to attend concerts for, and you know, at the time, who knows how long we were looking at. I think there was some hope, wishful thinking at that time that it would just be a couple of months.
Right.
But boy, whatever it was, it felt awful. And so, you know, from my perspective, we basically just started like streaming from our house, from our living room.
Yeah.
And it felt really right to me on my wife's Instagram account. Because it's a really rare moment that maybe some generations never even have, that we're all experiencing the same thing at the same time, at least maybe globally even. That's a really uncommon thing. Yeah. So there aren't any stages. There aren't really, I mean, there's still hierarchies, but the hierarchies are really much narrower when everybody has to fear the same, you know, thing. I don't know. I don't know. I'm digressing. What felt really good about it is like we're just acknowledging that there aren't any stages, and we're trying to get through this, and this is what we're doing to get through it. We're singing songs to each other and hanging out and trying to take advantage of being, you know, trapped in a house together. And I think it was a really sincere, sweet impulse that my wife had to share that with people, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it just seems so very genuine. I would say it definitely breaks a lot of the, you know, sort of rock star molds, if you will, to see you guys in such a familiar setting and you know, with your kids, you know, and all their personalities coming forward. I just thought it just had a real genuineness to it, and I think I bet you it really helped a lot of people through the pandemic because it was extremely popular and you're selling your wife a little short. She's got some serious cred. I read up about her as well as a talent scout, and I'm from the Chicago area.
Oh, yeah.
I remember Lounge Acts very well. Extremely important club.
No, I didn't mean to sell her short at all. And she's a formidable person for sure.
Like absolutely,
she's created them. I mean, she was a center, a key part of the scene in Chicago for many, many years. And so, So yeah, you should do a whole episode where you talk to her.
I could. She's got a lot of great connections.
She's a huge part of Illinois rock history.
Absolutely, she is. Well, you know, I want to thank you again for giving us some of your time, for loaning us your cool guitar that everybody's really enjoying. You know, the story of Wilco and Uncle Tupelo is very important for us. We think that particular genre specifically is a good story for us to tell because it has its roots in Midwest. We also tell the house music story here because that has its roots here as well. Right. So thank you again, Jeff, for taking time. We appreciate you being on our podcast.
I love that museum and that's one of our favorite places as a family. So thank you for helping keep that going and making it so vibrant.
Well,
it really is one of the best.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You're welcome here anytime.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Take care, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Take care. Thank you. Bye.
This has been the State of Sound podcast produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.